Let's see how this goes. I have a bad cold. My apologies in advance. First, I'd like to thank Ingrid and Lenore for making all of this possible. And I'd like to take also this opportunity to express my appreciation for all the wonderful work that the Earhart Foundation has done for so many years. In contrast to Bill Allen's good remarks yesterday, my own comments are going to be more oriented towards the categories that we use when we discuss the problem of nationalism. In fact, I wasn't overly pleased with the title of the panel. It is, of course, a pleasure and honor to speak to you on subjects which have been on my mind for quite a long time. Nationality is a complicated phenomenon. Unfortunately, understanding it has become even more complicated by much confusion arising from passing academic fashions. The purpose of my brief remarks today is to try to bring a little bit of clarity to the analysis of nationality and nationalism so that we might better understand the shifting dimensions of our own nation. I do have a particular problem on my mind, but as is typical of an academic, I won't get around to the problem to the very end of my remarks. The point of departure for any analysis of nationality is to distinguish nation from nationalism. And I want to explain why it's important to make this distinction. Nation is a term we use to designate an extensive yet bounded territorial community, as in the phrase, my fellow Americans. It is a form of kinship. It is a we of existential significance. Now, what I'm trying to capture here by this brief description of a nation is to account for two historically and culturally ubiquitous intertwined phenomena. One, individuals considering the land in which they live to be their homeland, and two, a willingness to die for that homeland. I've given you, there's supposed to be a handout in your packet, a few examples that indicate how ubiquitous the phenomenon of nationality is. And the examples that I provided long predate the Treaty of Westphalia or the French Revolution. The first example is from Genesis chapter 10. These are the sons of Shem according to their clans and languages, and their lands according to the nations. These are the clans of the sons of Noah according to their lineage in their nations. The second is from Plato's Republic. I assert that the Greek genos, with respect to itself, its own, and akin, and with respect to barbarian, foreign, and alien, then when Greeks fight with barbarians and barbarians with Greeks, we assert that they are at war and are enemies by nature. The third is from the Ten Injunctions of King Taiyo of Korea, 934 CE. In the past, we Koreans have always had a deep attachment to the ways of China, but our country occupies a different geographic location and our people's character is different from that of the Chinese. Now, we may, and we have, and we will continue to argue about how to translate the Hebrew term goy, which is translated as nation, the Greek genos and ethnos, about the Latin natio and gens, and the early Korean terms for country and people's character. Nevertheless, we ought to agree that we are dealing with some kind of territorial community, some kind of shared awareness of related we. Different from nation is nationalism. Nationalism is an ideology that repudiates all differing views and interests for the sake of one and only one uniform vision of what a nation has been, is, and should be. As such, nationalism repudiates civility and the differences that civility tolerates. Nationalism is an ideology that implies that there should be no political differences amongst the members of the nation. One way to think about political differences and contesting political parties, for example, the Federalist and Anti-Federalist in early American history, is that they represent different visions of what the nation is and should be. Usually, all nations have contesting views about what a nation has been, is, and should be. Thus, one merit of distinguishing nation from nationalism is that it takes into account the existence of differing views about a nation. If we do not draw this distinction, then we are unable between nation and nationalism, then we are unable to account for political differences in parties. There is another very important reason for the distinction between nation and nationalism, and that is we must also account for patriotism, the love for one's country. I know, as you do, that patriotism is out of fashion. I find this to be a troubling development, for I do not see how a nation can continue to exist without patriotic attachments to it. However, to be patriotic is by no means to be equated with an intolerant nationalism. I do not deny that there have been instances when patriotism has veered off into nationalism. For example, in American history, the Know Nothing movement. But patriotism and nationalism are not the same. Indeed, if I may say so, one task of the members of this society is to cultivate patriotism in such a way that it does not veer off into nationalism. These analytically necessary distinctions between nation, patriotism, and nationalism, if accepted, lead to a conclusion which I will put in the form of two questions. Is it the case that both political differences and the civility that tolerates them are made possible by the existence of a we, however disputatious, designated by the term nation? Is it the case that patriotism unites us above the differences that exist amongst us? There are, of course, numerous complications to these distinctions. Even so, these distinctions represent, so it seems to me, the necessary point of departure for an analysis of what it means to be an American. An individual's patriotic attachment to America does not preclude other attachments, for example, to one's religion or to one's locality, including one's neighborhood, region, or state. One can be a Catholic or Presbyterian and also take pride in being a Hoosier, while also being proud to be an American. The relation between such different attachments will vary from one individual to another, from one time period to another. The intensity with which they are held will also vary from one individual to another, from one time period to another. One sign of an America of free and responsible individuals is that we will find this variation, however vexing the variation may at times be. It is precisely the possibility of this variation that the ideology of nationalism seeks to suppress. To be perfectly frank, I don't think that I have presented here anything analytically controversial. If it weren't for the confusion cultivated by writers like Ernst Gellner, Benedict Anderson, Arab Hobsbawm, Edward Said, the proponents of so-called subaltern studies and cultural studies, these clarifying remarks might not be necessary. After all, the distinctions that I have made are to be found in venues far beyond patriotic organizations, for example, in numerous papal encyclicals of the Roman Catholic Church. These distinctions are to be found in the tradition of the Reformed Church. There are, to be sure, complications here as well. For example, for the Catholic Church, how to understand the relation between the love for one's homeland and the love for God. And for the Calvinist tradition, how to understand the image of a new Israel that has played and arguably continues to play a role in the formation of the American nation. Each time last night, in Professor Allen's remarks, every time he mentioned Chosen, there's that tradition. The rich and paradoxical relation between monotheistic universal religion and nationality remains a neglected area of examination. In these brief remarks, I can only say a little bit more about the relation between religion and nationality. However, before doing so, I would like to make one further clarification that has a bearing on our understanding of the shifting dimensions of the American nation. When we use the term nation, we must keep in mind that we are attempting to capture the existence of one kind of group of individuals, the existence of a certain type of we. What makes the we possible is the recognition shared among a number of individuals that they are related, as in the phrase, my fellow Americans. We are thus dealing with an understanding of the self and how, including the degree to which that understanding is shared with other individuals. Now, needless to say, an understanding of the self is not etched in stone. It varies. And certainly how that understanding overlaps with the self-understanding of others varies. This should be obvious. But what it means is that a nation must not be viewed statically or as a homogeneous phenomenon. We are dealing with a somewhat amorphous layer of self-consciousness that exists in varying degrees among other individuals. Now, since we are dealing with an expression of self-understanding when we refer to a nation, we must take up factors that contribute to that self-understanding. There are, of course, many. And they may, as I observed earlier, exist in tension with one another. One of these factors is how the past is a part of our understanding of ourselves in the present. When speaking to this audience, I will take for granted that we know that when bringing the past into the present, that past cannot avoid being subjected to modification. We have all read our T.S. Eliot. This is, if you will, the price that the past must pay to remain part of life. This modification, which tradition cannot avoid if it is to remain active in the lives of the living, can be circumscribed, hemmed in, by the existence of institutions, such as churches and courts, with their respective dogmas and law codes, but only relatively so. Now, what follows from what I take to be yet another commonplace observation? When we use the category nation, we obviously refer to the character of or self-understanding of a people and its territory, what we try conceptually to get at when we use the term culture. We usually also refer to a condition when a nation is organized with institutions so that it acts in the world, that is, when it is a national state. However, the reason for my having introduced here the observation that a nation presupposes a layer of shared self-understanding based upon the reception of tradition is to emphasize the factor of time and the ongoing constitution of a nation. What this should mean is that it is artificial to focus on one particular moment when a nation came into existence, whether that be 1776, 1789, or 1863. To do so is to assume the existence of the nation as if a nation is at some point in time fully formed. But actually, there is no such thing as the nation. There is no such thing as a fully formed nation. In my view, our historians of American history should liberate themselves from pursuing such a conceptual straitjacket. It simplifies the fluid and temporally deep character of any shared self-understanding. Before concluding, a few further observations ought to be made about the relation between religion and nationality, and the bearing of that relation on the shifting dimensions of American nationality. I will not take up here civilizational comparisons, important though they are. I take for granted that the American nation is infused with religion. I take for granted its formation as well as any number of relations, for example, that of private property, have drawn upon and express our monotheistic heritage, specifically the latter's understanding of the human being and humanity's place in the universe. I do not think that those relations can be adequately accounted for by reference to utilitarian benefit. And certainly those relations cannot be sustained by reference to utilitarian benefit. I do not wish to be misunderstood here. Having the freedom and ability to fly to Indianapolis, far be it from me to dismiss a utilitarian benefit. Nonetheless, those relations also require legitimation based on empirically unverifiable propositions of existential significance. For example, humanity is created in the image of God. You are familiar with these views. I don't need to go on with them any further. In these brief remarks, I can do little more than remind you of what you and I take for granted. I will, however, in passing, note two further points. First, as I have already observed, the investigation into the relation between religion and nationality remains relatively neglected. The second is that I have no doubt that the decline of the American character, specifically the increasing soft despotism about which Tocqueville warned, is paralleled by a decline in our religious discourse. I have some doubts about a decline in the religiosity of the American people, inchoate and perplexing as that religiosity may be, but I have no doubt whatsoever about the decline in the level of religious thought today. Our theology has not risen to the tasks of the day. Since I have referred to Tocqueville, I shall conclude with a point of irritation and a paradox arising from Tocqueville's writings. As you very well know, there has been much interest in Tocqueville's work during the last 25 years. There has been so much interest that, with anticipated boredom, we brace ourselves for one more dissertation, one more book on Tocqueville, produced from the factory lines of what has become our universities, with their increasingly poor doctoral programs. We are thus all quite familiar with what Tocqueville wrote in Democracy in America about the importance of voluntary associations. Through self-reliance, or what used to be called in historical jurisprudence self-help, the individual learns what it is to be free. The character of the individual is developed through having taken initiative and then bearing the consequences of that initiative. Furthermore, the individual's horizon of self-understanding is expanded beyond the self to include those with whom he or she has undertaken the initiative. Self-help, broadly understood, that is, taking initiative and bearing the consequences for it, is key for a nation of free and responsible individuals. This, too, is obvious, as is how the individual's conscience, forged by our religious traditions, is a necessary factor in taking initiative. However, to take initiative with other persons presents us with a nagging problem throughout American history. What is the scope, character, and independence of those voluntary associations or communities or corporations? The question today is explicitly before us in the conflict between the Catholic Church and the Affordable Care Act, currently in the appeal of the Little Sisters of the Poor, and in Burwell versus Hobby Lobby. Now, association and community are terms that should be used with far more care than how they are typically employed. Be that as it may, we can agree with Robert Nisbet that part of the character of the American nation has been a quest for community. Nevertheless, once again, the problem is the scope and latitude of the First Amendment right to associate, the right to form a community or association. How distinctive may an association be? If the distinctiveness of federalism, for example, amounts to not much more than differing amounts of welfare payments, then the distinctiveness is not significant. In such a case, the free exercise of the right to form associations is markedly limited by the state and its monopoly of the conception of public welfare. Tocqueville evidently understood what was at stake when was precisely this problem of the distinctness of the association. However, to see that he was, we must turn not to democracy in America, but to the old regime and the revolution. It was there that he complained about the influence of Roman law, what he called that law of servitude, in destroying what he called the ancient constitution. I do not know if Tocqueville had in mind not merely the distinctive provincial freedoms of Languedoc, but also, with passing reference to the ancient constitution, Francois Hotman's arguments in Franco-Gallia. In any event, Tocqueville did not push conceptually far enough to our problem. Nor did Nisbet. Neither pushed ahead to where the nature and paradox of the problem of the existence of significantly distinctive associations comes into focus. For example, in American history, a polygamous Utah, or a university that employs its own criteria for appointment and promotion. In conclusion, here is the paradox. On the one hand, we rightly recognize that equality before the law of the land is a prerequisite for liberty. All should be treated equally before the same law. I need not supply here the references to Hayek's writings on the rule of law, for the very same principles to be found much earlier in the law codes of the Bible, and I provide you with the quotation from Leviticus. You shall not render an unfair decision, do not show partiality to the poor or favors to the rich, judge your neighbors fairly. On the other hand, if we take seriously the existence of associations, beyond Tocqueville's examples of neighbors helping themselves repair a road, for example, where an association has its own law, as in the case of the church, or as it used to be, a university, what is the relationship of one legally distinctive association to another, and what is its relation to law of land? There will evidently have to be a basic law, akin to some version of the Bill of Rights, for adjudicating the relation of one association to another and the relation of an association to the state. What that basic law should be, how limited or extensive it should be, are problems to ponder while considering one possible dimension of the ongoing development of the American nation. Of course, the saliency of the problem assumes our nation's recognition of the propriety of a limited state.
Thank you.